Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a dramatic day in federal courts in Virginia, with Paul Manafort found guilty on 8 counts, 4 for tax fraud, 2 for bank fraud, and 1 for hiding foreign bank accounts. And in Manhattan, Michael Cohen pleading guilty to 8 criminal counts of bank and tax fraud and campaign finance violations. A former federal prosecutor who now teaches domestic and international criminal prosecution issues at Harvard Law School, Alex Whiting, joins us to discuss how Manafort, who is now facing 80 years in prison and another trial in Washington, D.C., is critical to Mueller's investigation into the extent to which Trump, his family, and his associates conspired with Russians. And now that Trump's former lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, has pled guilty to serious felonies and has named the sitting president of the United States as a co-conspirator in some of these felonies, we will assess what a volatile and volcanic Donald Trump will do as the law closes in on him from two directions. Presumably, in the next day or so, we will find out whether we are a nation of laws in which justice flows unimpeded, or a divided country led by a vengeful autocrat drunk with power who could plunge the United States into a constitutional crisis by shutting down Mueller's investigation to save his own skin while inciting his misguided base to rally to his rescue. Then we'll look into a new report from the Economic Policy Institute that finds America's top 350 CEOs made an average of $19 million in 2017, 312 times more than the median worker in their corporations. In a telling tale of growing income quality since back in 1965, CEOs were paid just 20 times more than the average worker. James Galbraith, chair in government business relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas and author of Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know, joins us. We will discuss what is driving this trend in the U.S. since the CEO worker pay ratio in the U.K. is 94 to 1 and 40 to 1 in Sweden. Then finally, we will speak with Ian Millhiser, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. He joins us to discuss his article at Think Progress, Breaking, Brett Kavanaugh Thinks Senator Susan Collins is Stupid. Today, in a reversal of her earlier pledge that she would not vote for a Supreme Court justice who would overturn Roe v. Wade, the senator from Maine either naively or cynically accepted Kavanaugh's assurance that Roe was settled law. And joining us now is Alex Whiting, a professor of practice at Harvard Law School, where he teaches, writes, and consults on domestic and international criminal prosecution issues. From 2010 until 2013, he was investigations coordinator at the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and prior to that was a U.S. federal prosecutor for 10 years in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, where he focused on organized crime and corruption cases. He's also the editor of Just Security, where he has an article, Why Michael Cohen May End Up Cooperating Despite No Cooperation Deal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Whiting.
Thank you and good afternoon.
Well, thank you for joining us, Alex. And I don't know whether you share my concerns that we are at a very critical moment in this country, because this is an extraordinary day of two, a verdict in one case and a plea, copping a plea in another, both of which appear to be closing in on Donald Trump from two angles. And, you know, he is certainly demonstrated a certain personality trait of being quite volatile. Do you think that these next few days could be very rocky for the United States?
They could be. I want to believe that we're too far down the track for the president to try now to stop the investigation with some rash action like firing Mueller or Rosenstein or something like that. That's my hope. But of course, this president has shocked and surprised many times before, and as you say, he is. Could feel more and more cornered, could feel like the momentum is moving against him, and this could be the moment that he lashes out. It'll be interesting to see what he says at the rally tonight, what he tweets tomorrow, if he responds in any way, if he tries to pardon either one of them or anything like that. But as I said, I think now what's happened today is these investigations have borne fruit. They're not witch hunts, and it's politically be very difficult now for Trump to try to shut it all down, because people all see that there is a there, and I think there would be a rebellion in the Congress if he now tried to shut it down.
But isn't it extraordinary, though, that Michael Cohen has pled guilty to serious felonies and named the sitting president of the United States as a conspirator, as a co-conspirator in some of these felonies?
It is extraordinary. So he specifically, what he said when he pled guilty is that he made the payments to Stormy Daniels and the other
Karen McDougal. Yeah.
Right. At the direction of the president and to benefit his campaign. And so what he was saying there is that the president directed him to break the law. And that is an extraordinary admission. Now, at the same time, one thing that was a little surprising today is that Cohen didn't enter into a cooperation agreement. Many people expected that he would plead guilty and cooperate to try to help himself. And the second part, the cooperation, was not part of the plea today. But as I wrote in the Just Security piece that you mentioned, the blog Just Security, he could, even though he didn't have a cooperation agreement today, he could still be required to cooperate with the Mueller investigation, because now Mueller could decide to subpoena him to the grand jury. And if he tried to take the Fifth Amendment, Mueller could immunize him and then compel him to testify. And if he refused to testify, then he would go to jail until he decided that he would testify. So there is still a path forward here where Cohen would be required to provide the information about what he knows about Trump's responsibility with respect to the payments, the campaign finance violations and the payments to silence the women, but also on broader issues. If Cohen knows anything about allegations of colluding with the Russians, he could be required now to provide that information to a grand jury and to the Mueller prosecutors. So this story is, this was a dramatic day. This was a very big development, but it's far from over. There's a lot more to come. Is Manafort going to decide to cooperate now that he sees that, now that he's been convicted and he will go to jail for a very long time? Will that change? That could change his mind, and he could decide that it's time now for him to cooperate and try to save his skin.
And again, I'm speaking with Alex Whiting, who's a professor of practice at Harvard Law School, where he teaches, writes, and consults on domestic and international criminal prosecution issues. He was investigations coordinator at the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and prior to that was a U.S. federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, where he focused on organized crime and corruption cases. He's the editor of Just Security, where he has an article with Andy Wright, Why Michael Cohen May End Up Cooperating Despite No Cooperation Deal. And Andy Wright, of course, was White House counsel, so he certainly knows about these issues. So tell me, when you talk about Mueller's interest in Michael Cohen, Mueller, of course, referred Cohen to the Southern District of New York's U.S. attorneys who have made the plea deal with him, or they're in the process of doing it, I assume. The key to that is, of course, the Steele dossier, where it says that Michael Cohen made a secret trip to Prague to meet with Russians, to collude with Russians to influence the U.S. election. And that's surely that is something that Mueller would be interested in finding out about.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's no question that if Cohen has not already provided information to Mueller's investigators, that he will be required to do so in short order. The other thing that is important about today is there's something about momentum in an investigation. And today was a huge momentum boost for the inquiries, the investigations, Mueller's investigations, all the other investigations of Trump and his associates for the full range of activities, because it's Russian collusion, but it's also campaign finance violations. It's also kind of ordinary financial crimes of close associates of the president. And that momentum is important because on the sidelines all the time there are people who are deciding whether they're going to provide information, whether they're going to cooperate, whether they're going to join up with the investigators and the prosecutors, two sides. And today we'll push, we'll push people to decide to start providing information. So these kinds of investigations have both investigative and political momentum, which starts to build. And that's what that this dramatic day of these two events, Manafort and Cohen, could be a kind of big start of that or continuation of that momentum that could propel forward the Mueller investigation.
Well, in terms of Cohen, there is another shoe that could drop, and I believe Mueller is already investigating David Pecker, the National Enquirer publisher, who's famous for these catch and kill stories, which are related to the payoff, of course, of both Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, the playmate. What I'm told is that David Pecker had what he called a favor bank, where he secreted all of these stories that he buried, mostly on Trump and his activities. If that favor bank is opened up by Mueller to the public, it might well be damaging.
Well, absolutely, and that's another part of this story, is that when you start digging and investigating, all kinds of things turn up, and particularly when you have characters like Manafort and Flynn and Cohen, and all of the shenanigans and the practices of Trump and his associates are getting exposed here. The big thing that that Cohen pled guilty to today was about paying off women, you know, to gaining the silence of women for the campaign. That's this kinds of shady, corrupt, sordid practices that are both financial and political in the campaign. These will all be surfaced by the investigation, and I have no doubt that there's more to come, that more of these practices will come to light as this investigation churns through and digs to see what exactly is there, and more and more people talk. So this is, as I said, this is a big day, but we're nowhere near the end of this investigation. And to go back to your original point, that's what's going to worry Trump tonight. He's going to see that this is not going to end anytime soon. And that realization may be what propels him to act in the next few days.
Well, I can't. Who was it in politics that talked about the big mo, the big momentum? I think it's the train is about to leave the station at breakneck speed here. And also, who's weighing in here tangentially, but he's very effective, is this lawyer Michael Avenatti, who represents Stormy Daniels. He's tweeting out now, "The developments of today will permit us to have the stay lifted in the civil case, and should also permit us to proceed with an expedited deposition of Trump under oath about what he knew, when he knew it, and what he did about it. We will disclose it all to the public." So Trump's getting it from a whole bunch of different directions, isn't he?
That's right. So there was the stay because of the ongoing criminal case, and that stay could be lifted. And there's clear Supreme Court precedent from the Clinton investigation that the president can be required to testify and provide information in a civil case involving events that occurred before he became president. So there's going to be no defense there for the president from to avoid having to testify or provide information. So I think Avenatti's right there that will become another avenue to investigate Trump and to get information. So it is coming in all different directions. The other thing we have to look for in the next weeks and months is to see if any of these characters provide information, if they decide to cooperate. I've been quite surprised that Manafort hasn't decided to cooperate. I think he's counting on a pardon. And maybe that's how Trump will try to shut things down, is he'll start pardoning people. But again, and this goes back to the point about momentum, now that people have been convicted and pled guilty and there's been all this drama, it's very hard politically for Trump to try to shut it down with pardons. That's just not going to play, and people are not going to accept that. So it may just be that it's too late now for Trump to try to fire people or pardon people to bring this investigation to a close.
Well, in terms of Manafort, it's my understanding that he is key to whether there's a case to be made by Mueller of Trump uses the word collusion, but conspiracy. And it's pretty clear that there's an awful lot of smoke, if not fire, there. Because, first of all, Manafort was working for the Russians and their puppet, Yanukovych. He got $9 million a year. He was there for 10 years. So I think he made more than the $60 million that was made public. His number two guy, I mean, he's the number one guy, his right-hand guy in Ukraine, Konstantin Kalimnik, is a KGB, a GRU, military intelligence colonel. He conducted, he apparently is very skillful, and he was a very good political strategist to get Putin's guy elected. But he controlled the Russian media account, because, you know, half of Ukraine speaks Russian. And that had to be directed by the Kremlin. There's no way in the world that Manafort didn't either work directly with Russian intelligence or at least have a liaison with them.
Yeah, yes, it seems that because Manafort had the kinds of ties and connections that you just described, it feels like he may very well have been a key part of this puzzle of conspiracy with Russians and Russian efforts to interfere with the election and so forth. It's hard to know, though. It's possible that there are multiple webs of fraud and deceit and so forth that are operating separately, and that you know, there are all sorts of different opportunities to make money over here, to influence the election over there. It seems likely that they would be related and connected in the same characters, but we can't know for sure. And so if Manafort decides to talk, then we might get information from him if he tells the truth. Otherwise, I'm sure that Mueller is pursuing lots of other leads to try to get around it. It's just hard for me to imagine that Manafort is going to decide ultimately to spend the rest of his life in jail, which is what he's now facing. So his two options are that he cooperates and provides the information, or he gets pardoned. Those are his two paths forward.
Well, just in closing, though, and there seems to be already evidence that Russian money did end up in the campaign, perhaps through the NRA and other conduits. There's also an equal amount of evidence that the Saudis and the Emiratis also funneled money into the campaign. So it really, if all this is proven, you know, one hopes that we as a country have a wake-up moment about what a terrible Supreme Court decision Citizens United was. And I recall at the time when it just came out, President Obama made a address to the Congress in the State of the Union, critical of this decision. And in the court was Justice Alito, who mouthed "not true" when Trump, when Obama said that this is such a bad law that foreign actors could influence our elections. And boy, that starts, that is beginning to look like a real possibility.
That's absolutely right. That's a really excellent, important point, that these investigations are looking at individual criminal actions and schemes and so forth, but they also bring to light some of the larger systemic problems, such as our campaign finance laws and the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which allow corporations to give money and spend money on campaigns and in an unfettered way. And when you allow that kind of activity, you're going to end up with the sort of corrupt practices that we see. So it's an important reminder that you've just made that we have to not just think about these individual bad apples, of which there are plenty, and more to come, but we have to think about the larger systems and policies and decisions that allow this kind of thing to happen.
Well, Alex Whiting, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Alex Whiting, who's a professor of practice at Harvard Law School, where he teaches rights and consults on domestic and international criminal prosecution issues. He was investigation coordinator at the Office of the Prosecutor at the International Criminal Court in The Hague, and prior to that was a U.S. federal prosecutor in the U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston, where he focused on organized crime and corruption cases. And he's the editor of Just Security, where he has an article, Why Michael Cohen May End Up Cooperating Despite No Cooperation Deal. We're going to take a brief station break. We look back, looking into how America's top 350 CEOs make 312 times more than the median worker in their corporation. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Galbraith, Chair in the Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Having served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, he directs the University of Texas's Inequality Project, and his books include The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too, and Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. And he has an article at The Guardian, Why Do American CEOs Get Paid So Much? Welcome to Background Briefing, James Galbraith.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Well, thank you, James. And you're certainly welcome to comment on the extraordinary day of news today before we get into the subject of your article, if you're up to it or interested.
No, go ahead.
Well, why then? You've asked the question, why do America CEOs get paid so much? Why?
Well, this is a study that was done by economists at the Economic Policy Institute, on which The Guardian asked me to make a comment. So I'm basically giving their report and making some observations on it. And what they found was that about 80% of the pay of the pay package of the top American corporate executives is closely tied to the stock market, which is no great surprise. It comes out of stock options realized and unrealized, and that's the where the big money really is. which has a number of interesting implications. It means, among other things, that what has happened to American corporations is in part due to the fact that their chief executives have such a very strong incentive to boom the stock price, not necessarily the same thing as keeping the corporations going over the long term as strong and competitive going concerns.
Well, we know that there's a lot of buyback of stock, et cetera. So that you're suggesting...
Well, buybacks, of course, are a corporate strategy, but one has to remember that the buybacks are enabled and facilitated by government policies, including, for example, the quantitative easing policy of the Federal Reserve, which made a lot of cheap money available to corporations, which they could then use to buy back their stock, and the Trump tax cuts, which cut taxes for businesses, giving them a lot of additional retained earnings, which again they could use to buy back their stock, and that's what they did by and large. There's been some improvement in the business investment picture, but a very large amount was almost immediately announced by major companies that they were going to use to raise their stock price. And of course, when you have a CEO who has a strong incentive to do that, it makes a very generous gift to himself or herself in a few cases.
So can you make the case that this excessive CEO pay is bad for American capitalists in as much as too much money is being diverted into the corporate suites and not enough into R&D and the shop floor?
Yeah, I think you can make that case. I mean, you can make it going back a very long period of time. The industrial corporations of the time when American industry dominated the world financed most of their investment out of retained earnings, and they were intent upon maintaining their global market share, certainly their national market share. And you have models of those American corporations that continue to function, in particular in Japan, in Korea, and in Germany. Those countries have corporations which continue to function by and large on those terms, and their chief executives are paid mostly in salary and mostly are committed to their companies over a much longer term than the American ones are. So this shift of the American corporation really since the 1980s into having the CEO basically strongly incentivized to boost the stock price has had a very bad effect on the viability of the companies that they run.
Well, I've always wondered why it is that American CEOs who move around like NFL football coaches, why it is they have such extraordinary skills that somehow they can move from a company that makes nuclear submarines to one that makes bicycles and cans pineapple.
The fact is, of course, that the companies are oriented to a very large degree to their financial management, and those abilities, if you want to call them that, are not specific to the industrial processes that are involved. But what it means is that the people who know how to make the can openers and the bottle tops and so forth are in a very subsidiary position inside these firms. They'll never reach the very top. They will be staying in those firms for as long as the firms are viable. And the corporate executives basically are finance people. And that's emblematic of what's happened to the American economy, the structure of the American economy as a whole.
And again, I'm speaking with James Galbraith, Chair in Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Having served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, he directs the University of Texas's Inequality Project, and his books include The Predator State, How Conservatives Abandoned the Free Market and Why Liberals Should Too, and Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. And he has an article at The Guardian, Why Do American CEOs Get Paid So Much? So when you consider the difference between the 312-1 ratio here in the United States in terms of income inequality between CEOs and the median workers. In, of course, the UK, it's 94-1. And in Sweden, it's 40-1. Japan also, I believe. Germany and Japan, the figures aren't hard to get. There's a lot of, particularly in Germany, right, a lot of private corporations.
That's correct. I'm a little bit wary of this very fashionable comparison of the pay of 350 people compared to the broad population, and that 312 is to the median worker in the industry, not necessarily in the specific firm. Mm-hmm. So what you're looking at is a comparison of what is basically stock market appreciation to payout of corporate cash flow. And that's kind of an apples and oranges comparison. But it is again, telling us about how the firms are run. It's also a very volatile number, actually. It was higher in 2000. Over the last 2 years, according to the study, it was flat, and then it rose 17% in 2017. You have to say, okay, why was that? Well, the stock market went up, and I think it's also likely the case that these corporate executives sensed that the market was going to peak out, which it has done, and decided to cash in, which then boosted their earnings in 2017. So there's all of that. It's kind of a manipulation. But let's not kid ourselves. There's 350 people making, in some cases, $20 million a year. That's a lot, but they're probably quite a lot of people, private equity, hedge funds, who make considerably more than that in the United States. If you're talking about the really ultra-wealthy, if you're talking about the oligarchs who've come in from Russia, or for that matter, are still there, or princes in Saudi Arabia, these numbers are, they're not the first thing you would look at.
Right. Mohammed bin Salman could even put Jeff Bezos to shame, I think, and Bezos apparently is worth $157 billion.
If you take a look at the scale of his palaces, that's I think, a fair observation.
Right. But let's talk about some statistics that I think are pretty indisputable, and that is that the richest 5% of Americans have captured 74% of the wealth created in this country from 1983 to 2010. That's a report from the Economic Policy Institute. And the richest 400 Americans control more wealth than the poorest 80 million of U.S. households, and the top 1% now hold 40% of the nation's wealth. Do you have any quibbles with those statistics?
I do have some quibbles with them. I think people who know my politics know a very strong progressive. But I think it's important to be aware that when those numbers are cited, the reference is to financial wealth, of which many millions of American households have practically none at all. So even the person who has $100 or $200 or $1,000 has more than a great many who have zero. So it's a comparison that one has to be wary of, and one has to be aware that there are social insurance programs of great importance in this country: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, deposit insurance, nutrition assistance. So you can go down the list. Housing support, which have been very strongly available to the middle class. They don't show up in those wealth figures, but they are the foundation of what makes a strong and successful middle class. What makes a strong and successful middle class is not a lot of people with small amounts in the stock market. It's people with secure retirements guaranteed by successful and stable government programs. And we have had that. They're constantly under attack. It's exceedingly important to remember that the progressive goal should be to sustain and support those systems so that we can continue to have a secure and comfortable and middle class, one which is able to support itself, but also able to look forward to a reasonable retirement and to protection in the case of medical emergencies and other things of that kind. And that's where our energy should be, it seems to me. And those numbers that we're just talking about simply don't capture that dimension, which strikes me as the most important dimension of a policy of social solidarity and social stabilization.
Right, but apparently 60%, I hate to keep quoting statistics, but 60% of Americans are $400 emergency payment away from penury. I mean, we're talking about CEO pay, but workers' pay has been flat since the 70s. So, you know, there's a great deal of social anxiety that comes with that insecurity, surely.
There is a great deal of social anxiety. I'm not going to argue that point. I'm just going to make a general observation, and I could cite statistics back at you, the difference between the United States today and the United States, let's say, in 1929, is an entire panoply of publicly administered social insurance programs that did not exist back in the late 1920s, that were created in the New Deal and the Great Society. And those programs have made and continue to make an enormous difference to American households. So if you're asking me, how do I assure that those American households that you just cited who are short cash are kept out of penury, the answer to that is I want to be sure that they all have access to, first of all, to jobs, and secondly, if they're disabled or if they're older or if they're in medical need, that those needs are covered by decent public insurance programs. When you do that, then the question of personal or private wealth is something which is certainly nice to have. I'm not going to argue it, but it is not fundamental to staying out of deep penury and distress, and that's the important point.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, James Galbraith, I'm curious to get your take on Senator Warren's new plan to radically change how corporations are governed in the U.S., limiting how the majority of profits flow to shareholders at the expense of labor.
I haven't read Senator Warren's plan, so I'm afraid I can't help you with that. But I do think that the question of how U.S. corporations, particularly the largest corporations, are governed is an important question. The question of how our banks are governed is an important question. And we've seen that the failure to effectively supervise our banking system is a major source of instability and disaster in our economy, and one which has not been, which was not fully repaired in the wake of the crisis. And the repairs that were made are now being dismantled. So it's extremely important to have these discussions about how the American corporate system is governed, to have what an economist of my acquaintance and indeed who shared my last name called countervailing power, in which the unions and the consumers and the public interest is represented effectively in ensuring that what we have is an economic system that serves not only private purpose but also public purpose.
Well, just in the last minute, will we recover from this huge giveaway to the $1.5 trillion giveaway that Donald Trump has given to the super rich in the name of helping the middle class? And then on top of that, the Secretary of the Treasury, Mnuchin, wants to give him an extra $100 billion.
You can always recover from that sort of thing. It's a question of having the determination and the political will and the votes to do it.
So
we've been in much worse situations before. It's just a question of getting organized and moving the country to an understanding of what needs to be done.
And there's an opportunity on November the 6th of this year, right?
I hope there will be. It depends upon whether the Democratic Party presents effective choices.
Well, James Galbraith, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with James Galbraith, who's the chair of the Government Business Relations and a professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He served in several positions on the staff of the U.S. Congress, and he's the author of Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know. And he has an article at The Guardian, Why Do America's CEOs Get Paid So Much? We can take a brief station break and back looking into whether the senator from Maine, Susan Collins, is either naive or cynical when she accepted Kavanaugh's assurance that Roe v. Wade was settled law.
The peddlers and the meddlers, they buy and they sell. They destroyed your city, they'll destroy you as well. The lecherous and treacherous, a hair meant for weather, each of them bigger than all men put together. sluggers and muggers wearing fancy gold. Here comes the dollar. Here comes the dollar.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And he has an article at Think Progress, Breaking, Brett Kavanaugh Thinks That Senator Susan Collins is Stupid. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ian Millhiser.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you, Ian. And today, Senator Susan Collins of Maine met with the Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, and she came out of it glowing, saying that we don't need to worry about his views on Roe v. Wade. He assured me that he's consistent with Chief Justice John Roberts in terms of its settled law, and therefore we all recall the famous confirmation of Chief Justice Roberts back in 2005, where he talked about stare decisis, settled law. So she's completely accepted that. I don't believe it for one second. Do you?
Yeah, I mean, Susan Collins is either really dumb or really cynical, and she thinks all of us are really dumb. So what's going on here is that we basically have a 50-49 Senate right now because Senator McCain is at home, you know, dealing with his cancer. And so if all the Democrats stick together and Susan Collins, who's a Republican, flips, Brett Kavanaugh goes down. Collins is at least nominally pro-choice. She claims that she won't vote to confirm a nominee who will overrule Roe v. Wade, but she either doesn't understand very much or she's intentionally playing dumb because, you know, she said, oh, I'm so reassured because, or she at least she compared Kavanaugh to Roberts so that Kavanaugh said he'd do the same thing that Roberts would do. And Roberts is definitely a vote to kill Roe v. Wade. And, you know, when you look at his record on the court, he has repeatedly voted against abortion rights.
That, of course, was the 4-5 decision on so-called partial birth abortion. But one of his more outrageous votes, of course, in terms of stare decisis, settled law, was Citizens United overturning 20 years of precedent.
Yeah, so they're like, this phrase stare decisis just refers to the notion that courts are supposed to follow precedent. And Roberts doesn't have very many compunctions about overruling precedent. You know, he overruled a 20-year-old case in Citizens United, which held that corporations can be prohibited from spending money on elections. You know, he's overruled longstanding antitrust rules. He's he overruled a longstanding precedent which protects unions. And then during his second term on the court, in a case called Gonzalez v. Carhart, you know, the opinion didn't use the word overruled, but in 2000, there was a state law that banned what are so-called partial birth abortions, and the Supreme Court struck down that state law. And then in 2007, Congress had passed more or less the exact same law at the federal level, and the Supreme Court upheld more or less the exact same law. The only difference was that the makeup of the Supreme Court had changed. So Roberts is not a guy who really believes that strongly in stare decisis, and he certainly doesn't believe in it very strongly when it comes to abortion. You have that Gonzalez case. You have another case out of Texas where he rejected a challenge. He was in dissent, rejected to a challenge to a really aggressive anti-abortion law. So if Kavanaugh does everything that John Roberts would do, that means that Roe v. Wade is toast.
Well, also, Susan Collins voted to confirm Gorsuch, and she got similar assurances from him, right? Which are equally worthless, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's probably going on here is that Collins wants to have plausible deniability. You know, if a nominee comes into our office and says, yes, I am going to go and overrule Roe v. Wade, then, you know, she's not going to vote for that guy because he didn't play the game. So long as the nominee plays the game, so long as they use, like, code words like settled law, then she's willing, you know, if they're willing to pretend like there's some uncertainty about what they're going to do on Roe v. Wade, she's willing to pretend that they're going to overrule Roe v. Wade. But I don't think that she, you know, she doesn't know what's going on here. And ultimately, what she has to decide is this. She's the senator who's going to have to run for re-election in a blue state. She's from Maine. In her next election is in 2020. She's got to run in the blue state of Maine. And it's likely that if Kavanaugh is confirmed, if the Supreme Court doesn't overrule Roe completely by 2020, they're at least going to make some pretty sharp cuts in it. So she's not going to be able to pretend anymore. You know, the court is going to hand down its decision saying, you know, either that Roe v. Wade is overruled or that Roe v. Wade doesn't amount to much. And she's going to have to run for re-election in that environment. So if she wants to look out for herself, you know, she's been able to play this game up to this point, but I don't think it's going to last much longer for her.
And again, I'm speaking with Ian Millhiser, who's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And he has an article at Think Progress, Breaking, Brett Kavanaugh Thinks That Senator Susan Collins is Stupid. So the thing, though, I mean, as bad as overturning Roe v. Wade will be, and I think it will have terrible implications for this country, and this red state, blue state divide will be even more profound because they're likely to kick it back to the states. So you'll have situations in red states where young women will be catching Greyhound buses to drive hundreds of miles to an abortion clinic in a blue state, and you'll have Christian vigilantes at Greyhound bus stations checking their papers to see whether they have parental consent. This is the direction the country's heading in.
Yeah, I mean, they may not even leave it to the states. I mean, once Roe v. Wade is overruled, there's no reason why Congress couldn't pass a federal abortion ban. Now, I mean, there is one reason. It may be that Republicans won't control Congress or they won't control the White House, but the minute there's a majority in Congress and the president willing to sign the bill that wants to ban abortion, if Roe v. Wade is gone, then you will see a federal ban on all abortion. And what that means is a practical matter. For rich women, it's not going to mean anything at all. Rich women will just go to Canada. But if you don't have the means to drop what you're doing, take several days off from work, fly to Canada, you know, get an abortion there and then come home, then you're going to, you know, those are the people that are going to be hurt in this regime.
Well, but though, Ian Millhiser, as bad as that portent is, what troubles me most about Kavanaugh is that when we have the most dangerous and reckless president in the history of the United States, who, as the former head of the CIA mentioned the other day, is drunk with power, this guy, Kavanaugh, wants to give him more power. That's his whole his whole outlook on presidential power. He just can't wait to empower Trump to do God knows what.
Yeah, I mean, Kavanaugh worked in the Bush White House, and what he got out of that experience is that presidents should be able to do more or less whatever they want. At least they shouldn't be impeded by criminal investigations or civil lawsuits. And, you know, maybe you can argue that past presidents were so busy that they didn't need certain distractions. But we're talking about Donald Trump here. You know, we're talking about a guy who spends hours and hours every day watching cable news and live tweeting it. I think what you see from Brett Kavanaugh, even the most charitable spin on what he's doing, is he's very obsessed with his theory of how things are supposed to work, and not very focused on the real world and how it actually works.
Well, that is the problem. I mean, these guys are looking more and more like bishops and cardinals in the Catholic Church, incapable of dealing with the sex abuse scandal. I mean, your book suggests Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. As bad as it is now, it'll be even so much worse. And in all of these confirmation hearings, nobody ever asks these conservative candidates whether they're corporatists. And it's so clear that they are, particularly in Gorsuch's case, and how much, at the end of the day, corporations will be empowered over consumers and the powerful, the rich over the poor, the corporation over the union. That is the trend. That's the reality. And these hearings are completely worthless because they never talk about the real stuff. It's all sort of dressed up in vague language. And when they're ever asked a real question, they refuse to answer it. So is this really just about the numbers? Is there any way in the world you can stop this guy? Because based on the numbers and based upon Susan Collins' ridiculous statement that this guy has assured her he's not going to overturn Roe v. Wade, which is, you know, absolutely worthless assurance, it looks like the numbers are going to go against the Democrats. Feinstein's meeting with him on Monday. I thought the Democrats weren't even going to meet with him until they got all the documentation.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what matters here is there has to be a lot of pressure. I mean, Susan Collins has to feel that she's going to pay a price. You know, the reason why Susan Collins ultimately voted not to kill the Affordable Care Act is because she thought she'd pay a price if she did. And so if her constituents are bombarding her with calls saying, do not confirm this man, you know, I still think there's a chance that that can be stopped. And you're right. I mean, it's not just the corporate agenda that scares me. What scares me the most is that these guys don't believe in voting rights. You know, Chief Justice Roberts has wanted since the early 80s when he was in the Reagan administration to nuke what remains of the Voting Rights Act, to say that you can't win a civil rights trial if you show that a law has what's called a disparate impact. It has a greater effect on people of color than it has on white people. And if you take away the ability to win suits that way in voting rights suits, that means that there's virtually no way to win a voting rights case where you have Jim Crow type voting discrimination. That means you're going to see things that you're already seeing states preparing for. This is a county in Georgia. It's a majority black county, and they want to close down 7 of the 9 precincts, voting precincts in this county. Why do they want to do that? Because black people will vote if they have a place they can go to cast a vote. In Alabama a while back, they passed a strict voter ID law. They said you have to have an ID to vote. And then they tried to shut down a bunch of DMVs in black areas so that black people couldn't get the ID so they could show up to cast a ballot. So that's the game. That's the end game here. You know, it's not just that these guys want to put in place a corporate agenda. It's that they want to entrench themselves permanently by making it so that, yeah, we'll still have elections in this country. But the result of the election will be preordained because the people who are inclined to vote for Democrats won't be allowed to vote.
Well, that's part and parcel of the great structural challenge the Democrats have. They have to win 8% more votes just to break even out of the gate. Right. And there's a study that I talked to Norm Ornstein about recently where by the year 2040, we'll have 70 Republican senators and only 30 Democrat senators because of the Electoral College and the gerrymandering. And populations are concentrating in cities in blue states where their votes are diluted. As we noticed from the last election, Hillary Clinton got 3 million plus more votes, but they didn't count. So that's the direction we're heading in. And it seems to be the job of the Supreme Court under this conservative majority that could be even more of a majority. Their job, they are the ultimate Republican activists because their job is to make the Republican Party a majority party, even if they are a minority. And this is their way of dealing with the demographic change that's happening by simply this manipulation of the law, of voting rights, and finding everything they can to maintain a tyranny of the minority.
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, the future we are looking at, if they get their way, is that they want to make it so that, you know, certain votes count for more. They want to make it so that, you know, there will still be some Democrats in Congress, but it's nearly impossible for Democrats to get a majority. And they've done that. I mean, they've done it through gerrymandering. They've done it through the Electoral College. They've done it through voter suppression laws. Some of these things, I mean, unfortunately, the Electoral College is actually in the Constitution. But, you know, some of these things are things the Supreme Court should do something about. It violates the First Amendment to engage in partisan gerrymandering. It's what's called viewpoint discrimination, because you're saying that the votes of people who agree with Republicans should count more than the votes of people who agree with Democrats. And the Supreme Court was supposed to strike it down just this last term. Justice Kennedy decided that he would rather retire and spent the whole term in a senior slump voting with his fellow Republicans. And so here we are now. I mean, it is grim. I mean, it's not, I don't think it is hopeless yet. It is essential that people turn out and vote in this November, that people should turn out and vote in 2020, because we are fast approaching the point where if people don't turn out and vote, then, you know, 4, 5, 10 years down the road, it may not matter how you vote in the election because everything will be preordained.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Ian Millhiser, what about some of the information that's coming out? I know the Democrats didn't want to meet with Kavanaugh until they got all the documentation from the National Archives, and that's been held up, and the Democrats want to make this stuff public. The Republicans don't. Feinstein is meeting with Kavanaugh on Monday, so that means that they've at least that stalling tactic is no longer being applied. Is it possible in some of this documentation there could be some smoking guns? Because I've heard rumors to that effect that he may well have broken the law, Kavanaugh, when he was so zealous when he worked for Ken Starr. But what's come out about his work with Ken Starr is the absolute, you know, almost like the Witches of Salem. I mean, we're talking about a guy that was just obsessed with the Clinton sex life and wanted the whole world to know about in the most lurid details. He also aggressively pursued documents tied to the Vince Foster suicide, which is really puts him in Alex Jones conspiracy territory.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly possible there's something in there that's standing and that could potentially shut him down. But frankly, I don't think you need to see that to know how to vote on this guy. I mean, he has a really thick record. You know, we know that he's against abortion, right? We know that he, like, time and time again tried to prevent the Obama administration's Environmental Protection Agency from doing its job. We know that he's very hostile to the notion of independent agencies, things like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau or the FCC or the FEC, these agencies that aren't completely under the grip of the President of the United States. You know, we know that he is against workers' rights. We know that he's, you know, when he's had the opportunity to vote on and has been hostile to voting rights. We know all of these things. And so, yeah, I mean, I'd like to know more about him, but I know enough to know that there's no good reason to vote for him.
Well, Ian Millhiser, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Ian Millhiser. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the editor of Think Progress Justice. He's the author of Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted. And he has an article at Think Progress, Breaking Brett Kavanaugh Thinks That Senator Susan Collins Is Stupid. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.